Does this give you renewed hope in electoral politics? I'm sure you have been very much outside of that scene.
You know, when Dr. Stein asked me to consider being a part of this, I knew that the historical conditions were ripe. I knew that we had a chance to really use the electoral process to advance people's agenda. I knew that there was going to be a tremendous support for this Green Party push. So it's about electoral process, but it's about building popular power. And when Dr. Stein said the theme of this campaign was about putting power back in the hands of the people, I said, I'm with Jill. Sign me up.
We're going to wrap up right now. I want to thank everyone for joining us. Winona LaDuke of Honor the Earth, Joy Braun of the Indigenous Environmental Network. Thanks so much for being with us from North Dakota. And I want to thank Dr. Jill Stein, as well as Ajamu Baraka, the presidential and vice presidential nominees of the Green Party. I'll be speaking in Seattle, Washington at the Sheraton Seattle Hotel on Friday night, along with Kushama Savant and Walden Bellow. Check our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Nermeen Sheikh, Dina Guzder, Sam Alkoff, Ravi Karan, Hani Massoud, Trina Nadura, Andre Lewis, Maya Bill Noguera, and Paul Huckabee, our engineers. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5 o'clock. The evening news is next.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Extreme Amateur Games BMX Competition. Round 2, Sunday, August 28th at D Block Indoor Skate Park in Clackamas. This is Round 2 in the Mad Bro Extreme Amateur Games. Winners are allowed to compete in the following competitions and in the final. Again, that's Extreme Amateur Games BMX Competition Round 2. Sunday, August 28th at D Block Indoor Skate Park, 8921 Southeast Jansen Road in Clackamas. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring. We are seeking a full-time AM News and Public Affairs Director. Applications are due by 4 p.m. Friday, September 2nd at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Applications may also be emailed. Send them to hiring@kboo.org. To apply, please send both a resume and a cover letter outlining your skills and experience with regard to the minimum qualifications. And please answer the question, why is KBOO important? For more information and a full job description, go to kboo.fm/AM News. KBOO is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. Women and people of color are encouraged to apply. Again, that's kboo.fm/AM News. And thank you.
Do you have used furniture, household goods, clothing, etc. that are good enough to resell? Make an appointment with Rerun Consignment Retail on Northeast 7th and Fremont and raise funds for KBOO. Make sure to tell them your stuff is for KBOO Community Radio, and after they sell it, KBOO will receive a check to help run our community radio station. For more information, call 503-517-3786 to arrange for a consignment appointment. Also call to see if they can accept your larger items. Thank you for supporting KBOO with your used goods.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, family and friends are still looking for answers from Clackamas County sheriffs after the fatal shooting of 19-year-old Christopher Coloni in Oak Grove. We have a special report on that case.
Portland Tenants United is organizing an entire apartment building to fight back against a 45% rent increase. The PTU's Margot Black is live in Studio 2 with an update.
And the federal government says it is phasing out its use of private prisons.
Mm-hmm. Good evening. This is KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 18th, 2016. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Robert Barncord. Private prisons have been a hot topic for decades. On Thursday, the Obama administration announced that they plan to phase out federal contracts with private prisons. Reporter Jemani Ward-Lewis has more on this.
The Obama administration said it will phase out its contracts with private prisons, affecting thousands of federal inmates. The decision announced by the Justice Department comes after an audit this month found that private facilities have more safety and security problems than the government-run prisons. The federal prison population has been declining due to changes in sentencing policies over the past 3 years, reducing the need for private prisons. As private prison contracts come to an end, the Bureau is not to renew the contract, or it should at least substantially reduce its scope. The federal government started to rely on private prisons in the late 1990s due to overcrowding. As of December 2015, private prisons held more than 22,000 prisoners, or about 12% of the total federal prison population, according to an Inspector General report released earlier this month. Many of the inmates were being held on immigration offenses, the audit said. The private prisons are operated by three private companies: Corrections Corporation of America, GEO Group Inc., and Management and Training Corp. For KBOO News, I'm Jemani Ward-Lewis.
The federal phase-out of private prisons so far does not apply to the Pacific Northwest's most notorious private prison. The Northwest Detention Center, or NWDC, in Tacoma, Washington, is an immigration prison ran by the GEO Group on behalf of the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. It is far from the only such facility in the country, but it is the largest on the West Coast, with an inmate capacity of 1,575. The Washington-based Northwest Immigrant Rights Project has an office that exclusively serves detainees at the NWDC, providing legal services and conducting workshops to educate people on the immigration process and their rights. The organization told KBOO that, to its knowledge, the phase-out of private prisons will not apply to the NWDC. In fact, it will apparently apply only to 13 prisons in the country, being operated on behalf of the Bureau of Prisons. All ICE and other immigration-related prisons will so far be unaffected, as will the many private prisons contracted by state departments of corrections. These contracts bring millions of dollars a year into the coffers of private prison companies, and it remains to be seen if states will allow the example of the federal government, will follow the example of the federal government. State DOCs claim that private prisons save money, but as U.S. Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates told the Washington Post this morning, quote, "You get what you pay for."
Multnomah County welcomed a new sheriff this week, but the county has opted to discontinue its investigation of the previous sheriff, who was recently forced out of office. Former Portland Police Chief Mike Reese took his place as Multnomah County Sheriff Wednesday, 2 years after retiring from a chief's career marred by his bad relationship with Mayor Charlie Hales. But documents show that county investigators have stopped their probe into former Multnomah County Sheriff Dan Stoughton, who was accused of creating a hostile work environment and retaliating against employees who complained about that.
An 18-year-old man shot several times by an unknown assailant Wednesday in Happy Valley Church parking lot will survive his injuries. Around 8:15, authorities responded to New Hope Church on Southeast Stevens Road. There they found Frank Niffon wounded on the ground. He currently remains hospitalized. The suspect is described as a man wearing a red shirt and a red hat.
Chicago Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson has called for the firing of 7 officers involved in the cover-up of the shooting of Laquan McDonald. McDonald, a 17-year-old black man, was shot 16 times by former officer Jason Van Dyke 2 years ago. The 7 officers are accused of falsifying their reports of the incident to corroborate Van Dyke. The reports were later contradicted by dash cam footage and McDonald's autopsy report. Van Dyke is now facing murder charges. The incident and its fallout have shaken Chicago, putting the tensions between police and the black community front and center. Last year, protests put pressure on Mayor Rahm Emanuel to fire the previous superintendent, and the U.S. Department of Justice is investigating the Bureau. Jamie Calvin is a journalist who founded Chicago's Invisible Institute and was instrumental in the release of McDonald's autopsy report. He spoke with KABU last year and described the shooting in the context of the changes people want at the Chicago PD, including greater transparency and accountability surrounding officer-involved shootings.
In some ways, this is the trickiest and requires the most leadership within the police department, is the so-called code of silence. You know, the culture within the department, and we saw it dramatically illustrated in the Laquan McDonald case, where, you know, at every level, at every turn in the unfolding, from the moment when the boy is shot and bleeding out the street to the $5 million settlement that the city entered into with the family, you know, at every point in that process, the impulse from, you know, officers on the scene to high city officials was to circle the wagons, was to push out a false narrative. When challenged, was to double down on that narrative. And, you know, to me, to this day, one of the most troubling things about the police response is, to the Laquan McDonald case in particular, is there were officers, the initial responders to the 911 call that there was a young man with a knife trying to break into vehicles in this, you know, deserted industrial area on the southwest side of Chicago. The initial responders were a couple of officers who handled the situation flawlessly. I mean, they did exactly the right thing. They asked the boy to drop the knife. He didn't. He wasn't aggressive, but he was kind of disassociated. They didn't push the issue. They called in for a taser. They didn't have one in their car. They thought maybe they would need that level of force. They didn't even call for backup. They called for somebody to come with a taser. And then they followed him, one of them driving the squad car, the other walking on the street a few strides behind Laquan McDonald. They followed him for several blocks. It's definitely a law enforcement situation, required intervention. And then they, you know, come to the site where Officer Van Dyke and his partner show up. And within seconds, they blow the kid away, you know, and we've all now seen the video and everybody knows how extreme. So I assume that those officers and the other six, seven officers on the scene besides the shooter, were as appalled as any other human being would be. There's no reason, because they're police officers, to think that they didn't respond with the same kind of horror that, and maybe more, they're on the scene. You know, they're seeing the thing. The same response that so many people have had looking at the video. But then think about it. The code of silence, the kind of de facto conditions of their employment, requires that they immediately turn around and lie about what they saw to protect a fellow officer. Well, those are just, I can't imagine more toxic work conditions than that.
That was Chicago journalist Jamie Calvin. Superintendent Johnson has stripped the seven officers involved in covering up the truth of Laquan McDonald's shooting of their police status. However, he cannot fire them outright, despite an inspector general's report recommending that they and a few others be fired. The former officers will have a chance to appeal their case to the mayor-appointed police board. Two other officers recommended for termination have already retired.
Yesterday, residents of an apartment building at Southeast 120th and Ash Street marched on their landlord's office and laid out demands. The group calls itself the Ash Street Tenants Association, and their landlord is the downtown-based A&G Rental Management. The Tenants Association was joined by members of the group, Portland Tenants United, or PTU. We are live in Studio 2 with Margo Black with PTU. Margo, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
First off, can you give us a quick background of Portland Tenants United and your relationship to the Ash Street Tenants Association?
Sure. Portland Tenants United has been organizing for about a year. We're the new tenants union in town, organizing tenants in the metro area, not just to insert or enforce their existing rights, but to join together in solidarity to demand greater rights and protections using direct action techniques and a variety of strategies. The Ash Street tenants, members of the Ash Street apartment complex contacted us a few weeks ago to let us know about their situation. And since then, we've been out there talking to all of the tenants in the building and doing, you know, research on the property management company and whatnot to determine what could be done to prevent their displacement.
How many people are in the Ash Street Tenants Association?
Well, there are 12 units in this building. Only 10 of them are occupied, and 2 of them are on leases, so they're not impacted right now by the rent increase. So that leaves 8 units. We have 4 who signed on at our tenants' meeting and 2 more who have agreed to sign on. So that's 6 units. I actually don't know exactly how many. I don't know right now how many people are in all the units to tell you exactly how many people that represents, but 6 households.
And what prompted the residents at 120th and Ash Street to organize themselves?
Well, I think, you know, it started with one tenant who just said, this can't be right. Why is this happening? I understand that this is legal. Like, she called Community Alliance of Tenants and they said, this is awful, but it's 100% legal. And she just felt really scared and alone and nervous and upset, and I really want to do something about this. Then she started talking to her neighbors, and they felt the same way, but individually they all felt really hopeless, like, well, there's nothing we really can do, right? This is legal. And then they started thinking, well, what happens if we all say no together, or we all join together and say, we're not going to take this anymore? Then it's not just one of us, it's 4 of us, it's 6 of us. Then you have the strength of Portland Tenants United coming and showing up for support and saying, you're not alone. This is happening to all of us. This is happening to everybody in the city. And there was, you know, when we were sitting down and meeting with them and said, how do you feel about starting a tenants association? They said, well, I think that's what we've already done. And they're just very excited about the possibility of experiencing this together and fighting together.
Mm-hmm. How has A&G, the rental company, reacted to their demands?
Well, when we went into the office yesterday, the employees of A&G just looked directly at their computer and keyboard. They didn't acknowledge us at all. There was a woman, I believe, from the building management company, but I'm not sure, who was pretty insistent that we leave and called the police. But nobody from A&G acknowledged us in any way. They didn't even look at us as we were reading the demands and telling the stories of the tenants in that building. But they did put out a statement afterwards that in a sense gave us our first small victory of extending their decision deadline from August 19th to October 21st. It is not what we asked for in our demands, but it is a small victory nonetheless. It takes some of the pressure off of the decision deadline of Friday for these tenants.
And aside from the renters banding together, is there anything unusual about this case?
Well, I mean, I think that what has been really compelling for Portland Tenants United and for other folks who've heard about this is that this is outer southeast Portland. These are tenants who, when they moved in, were and the building was only built in 2009. There's one tenant who's been there since 2009, but most of them have been there since 2012, 2013. They all were paying, you know, quote unquote market rate for an apartment in outer southeast Portland that, you know, has some crime in the neighborhood, and which is to say that it was maybe a little bit lower than a 2-bedroom in another part of town. They've all had regular rent increases since then. Our lead tenant organizer, Elena, had her rent increased by $100 a month last year. So they have been steadily going up. It's not like they're paying $400 a month or anything. And then to see a rent increase of $375 on tenants who have moved out here so that they can have less expensive housing in exchange for being further out from Portland and in what some would consider a less desirable neighborhood. I do want to say that I'm not putting down the neighborhood at all. There's a great neighborhood school there and a really great community out there. But what most of the tenants say is, I can't afford $1,200 and I wouldn't pay it to live here anyway. So to have such an egregious rent increase levied on vulnerable tenants who are already living where folks have been pushed out to has, I think, really put everyone on guard about how this crisis is starting to really bleed out of inner Portland, where we consider it to be most acute.
How do the new renter laws that Oregon created this year affect those renters in the Ash Street Tenants Association?
They were given 90 days notice for the rent increase. Interestingly, they were given 90 days notice, but also told that at the end of that 90 days, these are all month-to-month tenants, that they'd all be required to sign a 12-month lease, that the company, the new property management company, wouldn't be doing month-to-month rentals, and that they had only 1 month to decide whether or not they would accept those new terms and sign a new rental agreement, that's this Friday, or their tenancy would terminate. They had the 90 days, and that is really to give tenants more time to plan, but they also didn't really have more time to plan, because if you're thinking, well, is there a way I can make up that $375? They don't have that full 90 days to figure it out. They only had 30 days to figure it out and enter into essentially a binding agreement.
Oh, wow. And much like tenants, rental companies and landlords are not all the same. What has been the track record of A&G Rental Management?
I have to say I have not been very impressed with what I have been able to learn from just going over tenants' documentation, reviewing emails that they have sent to the property management company, most of which have gone unreturned. The Yelp and Google reviews are pretty negative. So it seems like it's a small company that is it's telling owners, hey, pick us, we will do all the work and just send you your rental income every month, but they are really dropping the ball all over the place. And I think we see that with this. They didn't come out and see the units after they assumed ownership of the or management of the property. They just sent these rent increase letters without even checking out the neighborhood and the quality of the units.
Mm. When it comes to Portland Tenants United, the big question is always, what else are you up to?
Well, tomorrow we're having a picket at the A&G management offices at 1800 Southwest 1st Avenue at 10 a.m. to ask them to rescind the notice and recognize the union and negotiate with us. We have a general assembly on Sunday from 4 to 6 p.m. at the Q Center, and we will be launching a citywide campaign for greater tenant protections and a rent freeze and a moratorium on no-cause evictions on September 17th with a march and rally beginning at City Hall at 11 a.m.
Great. And lastly, if our listeners are listening in learning more about and they want to learn more about Portland Tenants United or helping out, what can they do?
They can definitely come to the picket tomorrow. They can follow us on Facebook, pdxtu.org, sign the petition for the Ash Street tenants, share the news, share our stories, come to our events, become members, and start talking to their neighbors and friends and start organizing in their own buildings and reach out to us for support.
Great. We've been speaking with Margot Black with the group Portland Tenants United. They've been involved with a group of tenants that organized their apartment building in Southeast Portland to confront their landlord over a 45% rent increase. And they are having a picket at 1800 Southwest 1st Avenue tomorrow at 10 a.m. Margot, thank you very much for stopping by.
Thank you so much for having me.
The City of Portland project offering the right to return to displaced African-American former residents of Northeast Portland will only be able to help a fraction of the people who applied. Portland Housing Bureau officials say that about 1,000 people filed documents to participate in the program, but only 65 people have been placed on the list. Of those people, it remains unclear how many will actually get a home from the program. This is according to a Portland Housing Bureau spokesperson. Two local nonprofit organizations will help people from that participation list to purchase homes in North and Northeast Portland. The new homes will all be within the Interstate Corridor Urban Renewal Area, as defined by the Portland Development Commission. Meetings for the program's participants will start this week, but they are not going to be open to the public or to the media.
Portland's police department has been investigated by the U.S. Department of Justice for excessive use of force against people having mental health crises. But Portland's police are not the only local law enforcement agency having these problems. In this report, KBOO reporter Sam Bowman looks at a tragic incident in Clackamas County early this year and the controversial concept of suicide by cop used to justify it.
On January 28th of this year, A 19-year-old man having a mental health crisis was killed by officers of the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office. Christopher Kalonji's death was ruled in March to be a so-called suicide by cop. Kalonji was remembered by his mother Irene 6 months after his shooting, speaking to KBOO News Director Lisa Loving.
My son, he was a sweet boy who was special with history and constitution. He was one who likes to help his friends in different situations and support them. He was bright. He was like sunshine in our life because we never have a problem with him. He always, you know, come to us and talk, and when we speaking to him about some situation and show him right way, he always accepted. And he was a great personality who, you know, who have to go so early. And, you know, we lost him when he was 19 years. And it was tragedy for our family because we have a hope for him. He was so bright and could be whatever he wanted to be, you know. His passion was about people, and he was so, you know, so stick with this. Oh, I don't know what to say else. It just was a boy that make our lives and his friends' lives. And tomorrow it will be 6 months when he gone, and his friends and our family decide to gather in for his candlelight to just continue to remember him like a great human being.
The vigil she mentions was held on July 28th, 6 months to the day after Christopher's death. In the meantime, Irene Kalonji has worked with the Mental Health Association of Portland to draw attention to the issues surrounding her son's killing by police. Here she describes what happened that day.
This night, he get a mental crisis. It's like a mental breakdown. She was so scared. Because before he get arrested, and this day, it was his court day. He needs to go to Multnomah County for court. But he knows it was not right. It was arresting was illegal. And he mentioned that he get trauma for this arrest. And this day he has a mental breakdown about that people after him, you know, they want to kill him. And they don't want to understand that we have a rights by constitution. And it was just tragedy. So police was called to help, you know, to get him some support and calm him down. So, yeah, they come and they help. They just put him down. That's what happened, like short story.
It was clear that he was having a mental health crisis, and the circumstances that led to his death are heavily dependent on the fact that he was in mental health crisis.
That's J. Ashley Albies, an attorney with Creighton Rose in Portland, who represented the Kalonji family in the investigation into Christopher's death. She also currently represents the Albina Ministerial Alliance in the ongoing U.S. Department of Justice investigation into the Portland Police Bureau for excessive use of force against people having mental health crises.
There was attempts to talk to him that lasted for hours. The officers on the scene said that he reached her a gun and they were forced to shoot him. And then he was in his apartment and the officer sent in video cameras and used smoke bombs to try and get him to come out of the apartment. And that also took a couple hours. And he ultimately ended up dying and did not receive medical attention immediately after being shot.
5 weeks later, on March 3rd, a Clackamas County grand jury decided that the two officers who shot Kalonji were justified, citing a medical examiner who ruled that Kalonji's death was a so-called suicide by cop. The medical examiner, Dr. Larry Luman, based his ruling on Kalonji's behavior and actions in the presence of armed deputies. Ashley Albies, the Kalonji's attorney at the time, takes issue with this ruling.
So, as an initial matter, if somebody is killed by another individual, that's called a homicide. Regardless of motivation, whether it was self-defense, it still should be deemed a homicide. The legal justification for that shooting is something to be dealt with by the courts or our legal system, not by a medical examiner. For the medical examiner to conduct a cursory review of the facts as the police officers presented them and then make a credibility determination about those allegations and rule that Christopher Kalonji was attempting suicide by a cop, I think is extremely inappropriate and is deeply concerning for a number of reasons. The first of which, it's not the medical examiner's job to determine whether or not an individual had suicidal thoughts or tendencies if they did not kill themselves with their own hand or by their own means. In addition, when the medical examiner made the determination that this was a suicide case, he did it before the grand jury had made any determination about whether to charge the officers involved. In addition, when the medical examiner reports information about the cause of death to reporting agencies, whether it's the federal departments or the state departments or any other entity that gathers this statistic, this will be counted as a suicide rather than a shooting by police. And I think that's extremely problematic.
For the record, Kalonji's was the fourth police shooting in Oregon to be classified as a suicide by cop since 2012. Two of those incidents occurred in 2015. After the first of those, the state's chief medical examiner, Dr. Susan Gunson, said in an Oregonian article that she could recall only, quote, two or three rulings of suicide by cop in Oregon in her 30 years on the job. This list now includes three such incidents in less than a year, with a possible fourth occurring in June at the High Desert Museum in Bend, where Nicholas Berger was shot dead by an Oregon State police officer. Berger had held an employee of the museum hostage with a knife and was shot after letting her go and advancing on an officer. About 5 weeks later, his shooting was ruled justified by the Deschutes County District Attorney, but was not officially declared a suicide by cop despite the term appearing in nearly every media report of the event. One of the discouraging things about Christopher Kalonji's death is that the police followed correct protocol, calling in mental health crisis specialists who tried to talk Kalonji down for hours. Irene Kalonji expressed frustration at Christopher's situation before his death and how it played into the cop's reaction.
The most important thing for my son, because he was has this mental crisis, you know, he was need a help and support that we could not find, you know, on time. We want to police to be accountable for mental health people. We want them to realize they're persons that needs help. They are not a criminal. They are not their personality. That everyone to have to find a way to work with them and help them.
The Kalonji's lives have been turned upside down by the shooting of their son, and the destruction of their apartment by the SWAT team. In June, a Clackamas County court said the county was not liable for the damage to the Kalonji's apartment, given the previous ruling that the shooting was justified. The couple spent time on the streets ahead of the six-month anniversary of their son's death and have sought a new attorney to appeal that court's decision. Nevertheless, Irene Kalonji is trying to make the best of the situation by educating people about mental health crises.
I want just people knew my son's story. And I want you people to pay attention what's going on with their children. And from my situation, I could not help my son myself. So people need to go ask community, ask, you know, somebody who knows how to help these children.
For KBOO Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman. Lisa Loving contributed to this story.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned at 5:45 for an interview with Michael Shannon of the Fair Trade Campaign, talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, also known as the TPP. That will be followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6 o'clock. At 7, it'll be Ear to the Streets of Portland with Sequina Wright. Tomorrow's weather is expected to once again creep up towards 100 degrees. The expected predicted high is 98. East of the Cascades in Hood River, it'll be a little cooler at only 96. Today in history, in 1587, Virginia Dare became the first known white child born in what is now considered the United States. She disappeared months later along with all the other settlers of what was known as the Lost Colony of Roanoke in modern-day North Carolina. The quote of the day is from Will Rogers, a member of the Cherokee Nation, who said, "We will never have true civilization until we have learned to recognize the rights of others."
The large wildfire in San Bernardino Mountains of California grew to 49 square miles on Thursday. During the two days, countless homes and businesses have been lost and more than 82,000 residents have been displaced. In addition to the flames, three people have been arrested for looting an evacuated home. Local fire officials have been concerned for the safety of residents who have decided to stay in their homes or go back to check on their property. Workers with the California Department of Transportation spent Thursday replacing damaged guardrails in the southbound lanes of Interstate 15, which have been reopened after two-day closures and elsewhere. And elsewhere, Southern California, Edison crews are replacing 300 utility poles that were consumed by the fire. The wind-driven blaze tore through the dry brush of the San Bernardino Mountains and jumped Interstate 15. Many members of the local fire departments have stated this fire has an unusual ferocity due to the exceptionally hot and dry conditions. It hit hard, it hit fast, and it hit with an intensity that we've never seen before, stated San Bernardino County Fire Chief Mark Hartwig on Wednesday at Glen Helen Park.
While studies are showing that the public has benefited from President Barack Obama's Affordable Care Act, the corporate sector is pushing back on this. The Aetna Corporation this week announced that they would be shutting down their participation in the online health insurance exchange. That is, unless the federal government allows them to purchase another major healthcare corporation. Observers say that it's a power play that would allow Aetna to acquire Humana Inc., a move that might normally be opposed on antitrust grounds. An unprecedented release of Justice Department documents this week showed that the federal government has been unsuccessfully pressuring Aetna to release information on its business costs. Publicly, Aetna officials say that they're losing money on the healthcare exchanges. But the United States Department of Justice has blocked their merger with Humana since mid-July, saying that if it were allowed to go forward, it might result in higher prices for consumers. Also targeted by the Department of Justice was a proposed merger between the giants Anthem Inc. and Cigna Corp.
Another Trump news, the struggling Republican presidential candidate appointed a widely reviled conservative media figure as his new campaign CEO this week. Stephen K. Bannon is the chairman of Breitbart.com, news.com and now the CEO of Trump's campaign. Observers say his appointment means that the former campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, is being shoved to the background. While Trump officials say Manafort is still a part of the campaign, a Republican congressman from Illinois called for an investigation of Manafort's ties to the Russian government on Tuesday. Illinois Representative Adam Kinzinger is also calling into question Manafort's role in Russian President Vladimir Putin's campaign to annex Crimea.
After Governor Chris Christie was elected as governor of New Jersey, the current Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump got a major tax break for his casinos. The New York Times today reported that Mr. Trump owed overdue taxes totaling $30 million for years, But after Christie was elected, that bill was reduced to about $5 million. That's about 17 cents on the dollar of what Trump's casinos owed the state of New Jersey in taxes. The report comes as observers await Trump's release of his own personal income tax returns. His challenger, Hillary Clinton, released 8 years' worth of tax returns last month, and they showed that she and her husband, former President Bill Clinton, together made about $141 million between 2007 and 2014. And they paid about $43.9 million in taxes during those years.
The Zika virus has infected several individuals in Miami Beach, Florida. The virus has already spread throughout most of Latin America. Local health officials have been trying to decide whether to declare the population-dense area to be an active Zika transmission zone. If declared an active transmission zone, pregnant women would need to take special precautions to avoid exposure from the mosquito-transmitted virus. Zika can cause microcephaly and other serious brain anomalies in infants if the pregnant mother becomes infected. Currently, only the Wynwood neighborhood of Miami, Florida has been declared an active transmission zone.
The United Nations this week admitted that the cholera outbreak in Haiti that caused thousands of deaths after the 2010 earthquake was caused in part by the UN peacekeeping troops called there to help with relief efforts. It was a major admission after years of denials by UN Chief Ban Ki-moon. The admission came months after the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti filed a lawsuit on behalf of 5,000 victims of the epidemic. The victims are demanding a national water and sanitation system. They are demanding compensation for individuals and also a public apology from the United Nations for its wrongful acts. Several major studies have shown that a Nepalese disaster response team infected with the waterborne disease brought it back to Haiti more than 100 years after cholera had been eradicated in that island nation. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast. We encourage your participation. You can call us right here with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jemani Ward-Lewis, Kelsang Nima, and Grace Ann Smith. The producer is Sam Bowman. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News. Our engineer is Matthew Olson. Welcome back. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. Coming up on Friday morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Ani and Lynn host Positively Revolting Talk Radio. At 9, it's Veterans Voice with Marvin and Angie. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio. And at 11, hear a pilot program of a new show called A Radio Geekly. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a current member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Activists against the Trans-Pacific Partnership plan a major event this Saturday at Director Park in downtown Portland. To drive home the significance of the proposed trade deal, KBOO's Lisa Loving spoke with Michael Shannon of the Fair Trade Campaign for details about what is at risk if the TPP passes into law.
Now, talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. A relative of mine over the weekend was saying, well, Lisa, you don't agree with it, but I think it's a really good idea because dot, dot, dot. Now, you tell us, what's going on there? For people that have heard of TPP, but they think it's something they get in the paper aisle of the grocery store.
Well, the first thing is the Trans-Pacific Partnership is the largest free trade agreement ever negotiated. So it's larger than the past free trade agreements like the North American Free Trade Agreement or the Central American Free Trade Agreement. And it's not only larger, it's more of the same bad policy and then some. These free trade deals are really about removing regulations so that not just goods and services, but also capital can move across borders with less boundaries. And when we look at what do we want? Do we want goods and services and profit moving more easily? Or do we want workers taken care of and our environment protected? And those are not necessarily at odds if everyone was at the table when negotiating the Trans-Pacific Partnership. But who wasn't at the table were labor unions, frontline workers, climate activists, human rights advocates, and public health experts. So we got a deal negotiated by corporate interests that serves corporate interests.
Okay, just to briefly go back, you had said this is the largest partnership or trade deal of its kind. How do we judge that? What is larger about it than, say, for example, some of the ones that the Clinton administration negotiated?
Well, that's really easy because there's two big ways in which it's larger. Using the North American Free Trade Agreement as an example, that was an agreement that covered three countries: Canada, United States, Mexico. The Trans-Pacific Partnership has 12 countries, and for the first time ever, this free trade agreement has the ability for countries to join on in the future. So when NAFTA was negotiated, it was a pact. Three countries, no one else could join in. But the Trans-Pacific Partnership actually has a mechanism for countries to join in the future. So it's the number of countries that makes it larger, but also the amount of the economy covered. When you look at the, and I don't have the number for the North American economy compared to the global economy, but the Trans-Pacific Partnership will set rules for 40% of the world's economy.